Okay, good morning, everyone. Good morning. Brishus, Rabbi Reis, Rabbi Schechter. As is always appropriate to say on a legal holiday, Yashar Koyach, for using your time off the appropriate way. Obviously, you wish you could learn every day of the year, but you have to make a parnasa. But when you have the opportunity to spend a little extra time at the base medrash, that's definitely the proper way to do. This morning, we had a tremendous chus to Rabbi Yonah Reis, Shlita, the Abbas in the CRC, give a share on the topic of civilian casualties during war. Aside from the fact that Rabbi Reis is familiar with Dalal Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, but unfortunately he's had to deal with serious situations similar to this in the past. He's very involved in a lot of the Piskei Halacha after 9/11, and Shaila's related to war as well he's had to deal with, and therefore it's appropriate to hear from him an Ian share on this particular topic. Rabbi Reis.
Thank you very, very much, and Vashusa, Rabbi Robinson, Rabbi Schechter. It's an honor to be able to address you this morning and to give this special shiur. It's a very challenging topic, and I'm not going to be able to necessarily cover the entirety of the topic in the 40 minutes or so that we have this morning, but I wanted to really go over Rosh Prakim. But one thing that I think is very important to mention, just as an introduction, is that when we speak about the conundrum or the dilemma regarding civilian casualties, which is pretty much an inevitable result of any war, that when one nation goes against another nation that is its enemy, that in all likelihood, there will be civilian casualties to the degree that there is any kind of a desideratum to minimize civilian casualties, to the degree that there is a Geneva Convention that stipulates certain rules that were adopted by many, many nations not to engage in indiscriminate warfare where one is not mindful of trying to avoid civilian casualties, to the degree that there is any kind of international law or protocols that are out there. I think that it is beyond any question whatsoever that the current state of Israel, which is engaged in the war right now against the Hamas, has the most moral army in the entire world when engaged in these battles, and really goes overboard, probably beyond that which we will see is really required by the halacha, probably more so than any other country, is extremely scrupulous and careful about following the Geneva Convention Accords, so that any criticism that's leveled against Israel really has absolutely nothing to do with any kind of an indifference to civilian lives, but has to do more with the incredible hatred and tremendous sinner that the many nations and many individuals within the nations have and always have had towards the Jewish people. And probably a good illustration of that is the outrage that was demonstrated after there seemed to be a bomb that fell in the vicinity of the Al Ali Arab Hospital shortly after the war began, and there were alleged many casualties and deaths of individuals who were in the hospital, whatever the figure was or really was. And the New York Times, right after it occurred, simply took the word of those who were on the Hamas side, because obviously they're such Ehrlich, trustworthy individuals, that the bomb came from Israel. And the report was that the entire Middle East is seething. The word was seething. I remember reading the headline, they're seething, because of the deaths of these individuals. Now, why were they seething? Seething because presumably it was a bomb that came from Israel that was targeted towards terrorists that would be 100% legitimate. They may have gone the wrong way, and there would have been civilian casualties, but they would be seething. That would be completely unforgivable. But then it came out within the next couple of days that it didn't really come from Israel. It was a rocket that was launched by the terrorists. a rocket that was launched not in self-defense, not to attack terrorists, but to attack and to kill innocent civilians on the side of Israel. And that's the rocket that went wayward and ended up falling in the hospital, causing all of these people to be killed. And suddenly, absolute radio silence. Nobody's seething anymore. Nobody's seething. All is forgiven. Everything is fine. That's understandable. Nothing to talk about, folks. Let's move on to the next thing. It goes to show that those who condemn Israel with respect to this issue could care less about civilian casualties. The only one who cares about civilian casualties is Israel itself. So it's absolute nonsense to be engaged in this conversation, to talk about, oh, is Israel moral or not moral when it comes to this issue? There's no army, no people who's more moral than Israel. Those who condemn Israel because of this issue, they will try to find any kind of pretense, any kind of excuse to attack Israel, to call self-defense genocide, and other types of absolute horrific nonsense. So we know exactly where it's coming from. It's not coming from any tzidkus. The Stiplagon famously wrote in his Musar Sefer that the world that we live in today is an Alma de Shikra, and all of the people who profess the great righteousness could care less about righteousness. The judges who are charged in the secular world to do righteousness will, you know, give very holy and pious speeches, and then take vacations for 2 months while everybody is waiting for justice to be served, and not think twice about it. It gives many, many examples. All you have to look is the way in which the nations of the world are responding to the current battle, to the protests that take place on the college campuses, which are supposed to be bastions of enlightenment. And you get a sense as to how much you can trust the intellectualism and the morality and the integrity of the world around us. So one thing that we have learned from this entire conflict is how much sheker there is in the world. So I want to make that entirely clear. But this year is about emes, the emesdik position from the standpoint of halacha, and that's really what I want to discuss. So the many of the sources that address the issue of civilian casualties are really sources straight out of Tanakh. There aren't so many sugyas in the Gemara, per se, with respect to this issue, and probably a lot of that has to do with the fact that it was viewed almost as a hilchus of the Mashiach, that you didn't have a sovereign Jewish state as the sugyas of the Gemara were being written. So it's not the sort of thing that came up so much. It did come up in terms of episodes that we have in Tanakh, when we had armies and when we would be more engaged in battle. So Rav Asher Weiss, for example, writes that when it comes to this particular sugya, you really have to look a lot at Tanakh. So one major place in Tanakh is the story of Shechem, where we know that there was this Shechem ben Hamor from the ruling party in Shechem, found Dina, who was, of course, the daughter of Yaakov Avinu, and abducted her and decided that he wanted Dina for his wife. But it was a hostile hostage-taking, essentially, that took place. And the question was, how would Yaakov and his family react to this? There was already the beginning of Klal Yisrael, in the sense that Yaakov had the Yud Beis Shvatim and was beginning to form the fledgling nation of the Jewish people. And the question is, if there would be a war, one shaila is, was this a war that was being waged by a nation, or was this simply an individualized situation? Some commentators understand that this was already a war waged by a nation, to the extent that Shimon and Levi then went to battle against Shechem and Hamor and all of the men of Shechem, that maybe we can view that as essentially a wartime battle. And others say, no, at this point in time, we weren't dealing with a national identity. It was a skirmish involving a family. And that will have a certain nafkamina, a certain distinction in terms of how the commentators deal with the story. But we know the story that Shimon, that the Bnei Yaakov and Yaakov Avinu sat down with Shechem, sat down with Hamor, and they said that you want to make peace with us and you want to keep Dina, so fine, we'll enter into a peace treaty with you, we'll do business with you, we'll exchange our daughters, sons, they'll all get married with each other, but you have to join our faith. You have to have a bris milah, and everybody listen. Shechem and Hamor went back to the people of their city, and they said, everybody has to get a bris milah, and the people innocently followed, and they figured they're going to have a nice peace pact with the Jewish people. And then as they're recovering from the bris milah, they were very weak and vulnerable. Shimon and Levi on their own took upon themselves to kill Shechem and Hamor and all of the men of Shechem. And Yaakov said, Achartem osi, l'avishenim yosheva aretz, you have disgraced me, you have sullied my name. Our brand, the brand of the Jewish people from its very inception, was our high level of morality. You made me look immoral. You made me look very bad. And you've also put me in a situation of a sakana. One question is, what's the dagish? Is the emphasis that you acted in an immoral fashion that's not the way that you're supposed to act? Or that maybe you really could act this way, given that there was a hostile act of aggression against the Jewish people, and it was okay, maybe strictly speaking, to kill all of the inhabitants of Shechem and to trick them in this fashion, but you nonetheless put me in sakana. And who has the last word? It sounds a little bit from the parsha in Vayishlach that Shimon and Levi have the worst last word. They say, "V'yomach zonaya says achosena, should our sister be taken hostage, be abducted, and be treated like a harlot?" So we feel that we did the right thing. However, afterwards in Parshas Vayichi, we find that when Yaakov was meeting out the brachos to his children, he did meet out some criticism about this even then to Shimon and Levi. He said, "B'sodama al tavo nafshi v'keilam al teichad kevodi ki v'apam havgu ish v'atsonami kushur," that I don't want to be associated with your type of behavior because you acted impetuously, temperamentally, in a way that you killed individuals in the wrong fashion. And Rashi says, "Ki v'apam havgu ish," is a reference to Eidu Chamor v'Anshei Shechem. This is a reference to Chamor and the people of Shechem that you didn't do the right thing. So the question is, so what is the halacha? Did Shimon and Levi act properly? This would seem to be a case of civilian casualties, but worse than civilian casualties, if you think about it, because Shimon and Levi specifically and intentionally targeted the inhabitants of Shechem who were not involved, presumably, in the abduction of Dinah, and that they went door to door, actually, specifically, killing all of the inhabitants whom they knew to be innocent, and when they really could have stopped at only killing Hamor and Shechem, who were clearly the guilty parties of whatever abduction that took place. This isn't a question of they were trying to get Hamor and Shechem, and Hamor and Shechem were in a big building with lots of other people, so the only way that using all of the inhabitants as their human shield, so to speak, the way that Hamas does, and the only way to kill Hamor and Shechem would be to kill the Anshei Shechem. That wasn't what was going on over here. They deliberately targeted the Anshei Shechem. So the Rambam says, the Anshei Shechem were all chayav misa. It was okay. Strictly speaking, as a matter of halacha, maybe there were good military, strategic, other reasons not to have done it that caused Yaakov to be upset. Maybe they didn't follow proper protocols. However, from a strict halachic perspective, there is a requirement for the B'nai Noach, for all non-Jews, to follow the seven Noahide laws. One of the seven Noahide laws is to establish dinim, that you have to have a justice system, and it's the responsibility of every single person amongst a non-Jewish nation to set up a justice system. They didn't set up a justice system. They didn't have proper courts. They didn't have a proper judiciary to bring Hamor and Shechem to justice. And because of the fact that the people didn't establish a justice system, we have a principle in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Asarasan Zui Misason, that with respect to the seven Noahide laws, any law that is violated by the B'nai Noach is deserving of the death penalty. Since they were deserving of the death penalty, therefore, that is, since they didn't set up the judiciary, which is one of the seven Noahide laws, so then they became deserving of the death penalty, and because of that, it was justifiable, at least from a pure halakhic perspective, says the Rambam, for the Anshei Shechem to have been killed by Shimon and Levi. So the Rambam says in the second source. The Ramban takes issue with the Rambam and says that can't be so. He says it can't be so because if you think about it, on some level, first of all, the B'nai Shechem did not necessarily have the ability to set up a justice system, says the Ramban, because if their leadership, if their totalitarian, dictatorial leaders had committed a heinous crime and they would try to bring them to justice. So you know what would happen to the Anshei Shechem? They wouldn't stick around for too long. Imagine if you had people within Gaza who would get up and they would speak against Hamas. So we know what Hamas would do, and that's presumably a possible justification. I haven't heard anybody who is a refugee from that area say, oh, well, the reason that nobody's speaking up is because we all hate Hamas and we're against Hamas, but we're afraid that we'll have our heads cut. So I haven't found those people, and you have to really wonder a little bit whether there shouldn't be some culpability on this basis. Are they really just worried about having their heads chopped off, or is it that they voluntarily accepted upon themselves Hamas as their representative leadership because they actually elected Hamas? Is there an argument, well, they had no choice but to elect Hamas? I'm not sure that that's really true at the time Hamas was elected, so there really is a possible argument that maybe the Hamas situation is different from the Anshei Shechem. But Ramban says that he feels that they didn't necessarily have the ability to stop the Hamor and Shechem from whatever it is that they did. And furthermore, establishing a justice system, he says, is only a mitzvah's essay. That's a positive commandment. Only for the negative commandments of the seven Noahide laws, like not killing and not stealing, would they be worshipping idols, for that matter? Would they be chayav misa? Would they be culpable for the death penalty? But for the failure to establish courts, that does not carry with it culpability. But he says the truth of the matter is, if you want to find grounds for them to be chayav misa, so they did all worship idols, they were all idolaters, so for that reason, they could have been chayav misa. But he says the reason why Yaakov got angry at them is because, number one, it wasn't their responsibility. It wasn't the responsibility of Shimon and Levi to mete out the death penalty because there was no crime that the Anshei Shechem, with respect to Hamor and Shechem, 100%, they certainly would have been worthy of the death penalty being carried out against them by Yaakov and by Shimon and by Levi because they violated lo signovu. They stole, they abducted Dinah. But and that was a crime that was committed against Yaakov and his children. However, the other, if they're worshiping idols, that's not a crime that was committed against Shimon and Levi. And maybe since there was this idea they're going to do a bris milah and join the Jewish faith on some level, maybe Ulai Yashuvu al Hashem, maybe they would have completed their tshuva. Who says that they wouldn't have done tshuva? V'hargu osam chinam. In which case, the death penalty would have been unwarranted. And number two, because of the fact that there was sort of this promise that was made to the Anshei Shechem, they were lulled into a false sense of security by Shimon and Levi. So therefore, one thing that we do not want to do is to act like Hamas, like those types of people. So that's what the Ramban says. He says, Ki asu Hamas, the Anshei Yair. They acted like Hamas. They acted in an underhanded fashion. That's what our enemies do. That's what the enemies of the Jewish people do. That is not what we do. And they also brought us into sakana. And even this explanation that by their actions that they brought our people, they brought the fledgling, burgeoning nation of Yaakov of Anav of Klal Yisrael into danger. You could say because they harmed our brand. What is it that enables us to stand above all of the other nations? It's our high level of morality, but they didn't act in that moral fashion. So the Ramban says, for all of these reasons, it was improper. Based on the Ramban, there is no justification for targeting civilians. Based on the Rambam, you could say that there could be a justification if the civilians are somehow complicit in terms of not seeing to it that there is a proper justice system and being responsible on some level for the fact that there isn't a justice system in place, that there are terrorists who are running the country, then there could be actually a justification according to the Rambam. That justification would probably not extend, though, to those who really were innocent, who really were not charged with the ability to establish a justice system, certainly the women, the children, who wouldn't necessarily have a say in the matter. So that would be off limits, even according to the explanation of the Rambam. Yes, question, Rabbi Shechter.
Yeah, so you mentioned now and before that we don't know how many people in Gaza are complicit and support. So let's say, again, you know, we don't know what's true, what's not true, but let's say I saw somewhere that says 65% of Gazans support Hamas, and they support it for real. Can we go with the Roiv? Can we go with the Roiv in this case and say, well, the Roiv of the, so it's Mutter, or because there's an Ein Halacha, by Nefashos, you know, about the Roiv, is that only for Klal Yisrael? Or either way, it wouldn't justify the other 35%.
Nobody makes the argument that you can go after Rov if you have even one single innocent party. Then we don't go after we don't go after Rov. The same idea that we don't give up even one innocent person, like the Tosefta says in the Trumos, and the Yerushalmi says in Trumos, in order to save an entire city, you don't give over one person. But the Rov, you're going to only forfeit one person in order to save everybody else. So we don't follow Rov when it comes to Dinei Nefasho, so therefore that would still be a problem. But according, and Rabbi J. David Bleich writes that when it comes to those types of calculations, we also don't distinguish between Jews or non-Jews. The same rules and principles, according to the vast majority of Mephoshim. There's a Rashi and Sanhedrin that would seem to indicate these calculations only apply to Jews. But he says that many, many other Mephoshim, including a famous Meshech Chochma, talks about the severity of killing a non-Jew as being perhaps even more severe than killing a Jew. He says the most Mephoshim would say that the same calculations would apply to non-Jews as well. However, there is a Maharal. Maharal takes another approach, and that's the source at the bottom of page 2. The Maharal says, I'll tell you what was going on with respect to Shimon and Levi. Regardless of the political considerations that may have made Yaakov upset, he says that really Shimon and Levi would not have committed an act of wanton murder. They were not murderers, Shimon and Levi. Maybe they didn't follow proper protocols, but in terms of murder, they wouldn't have committed murder. So he asked the question, so I want to know, given that we assume that Shimon and Levi were not murderers, they would not have killed the people if there was no justification, so what exactly was the sin that was committed by the Anshei Shechem? So he says that, and he quotes the Rambam, and he doesn't like the Rambam because of what the Rambam says, because he says that the people really had no choice in the matter. With respect to what Shechem and Hamor did, as I mentioned earlier, because their onus Rachman and Patre, they were subject to the rule of Shechem and Hamor, they wouldn't have been able to stop them. So you can't say that they were guilty for not carrying out justice. But he says, look at the top of page 3, Nimad lo kashamidi, Mishlum lo dami shnei umos kagon b'nei Yisrael k'nanim, shehem shnei umos. He says that whenever you're dealing with a wartime situation of one nation against another nation, then it is an entirely different situation. Then you are subject to the rules of war. Look at 3 lines from the bottom of this source, that because of the fact, kimen sheparzu lehem tzechila, because the other side had begun the aggression, and therefore this was a justifiable war, the Rambam says that there's a category of melchemes mitzvah, a melchema which is an absolute mitzvah, and then there's a category of melchemes reshus, there's what we call optional wars. What's a melchemes mitzvah? That's when a Kodesh Baruch Hu says, go against certain nations, like go against the Shiva Amomim, the 7 nations who were in Eretz Yisrael when we conquered Eretz Yisrael. That was a melchemes mitzvah. Fight against the Amalek, that's a melchemes mitzvah. What's also a melchemes mitzvah? Says the Rambam, when you are attacked and you fight back, so that is a melchemes mitzvah. Be'ezras Yisrael miyad sar shebo'aleim. That when you need to protect yourself from an enemy that has attacked you, that is a melchemes mitzvah. So you're dealing with a melchemes mitzvah situation, a genuine, justifiable war. Mutarim likach m'pasim mehem. You're allowed to exact your revenge against the enemy. And this is true with respect to every single war. Second to last line, even though there are many non-combatants amongst the enemy, you cannot differentiate. You go to war, you don't have the ability to fine-tune and cherry-pick and pinpoint exactly where every single real combatant is located. You're going against the enemy. There will be civilian casualties. That's the nature of war. Since there were those who had done evil, you can go after everybody else. And that's the way that all of the wars work. These others, the other who said authority, who says this very, very clearly, look on page 5, source at Yudalid, is the Netziv. Berlin, it says as follows. I've been telling you the Berlin. We have a pasuk in Bereishis that says that Ve'achis dimchem l'nafshos seichem et rosh. God holds all of humanity accountable for murder. Miyad kol chayad reshenu, miyad adam, miyad ish achiv. That when one brother strikes his brother, miyad ish achiv, et roshis nefesh adam, then there's culpability for murder. So it says to the Netziv, why do we use this lashon miyad ish achiv? A person striking his brother, ish achiv. What's that lashon? Why don't you say ish adam? If you kill another person, so you're culpable. Why ish achiv, your brother? Why is it to be only your brother? So he explains that we have a time for everything, right? There's a time. Shalom. He says that this is what this pasuk is connoting to us. That it's only when it's b'shash shiroi linog be'achava. When are you liable for murder? When it's a time to act with brotherly love. If it's a wartime, that's not a time to act with brotherly love. The other side, they're out to kill you, and you have to kill them. This is a time of to hate, a time to kill. If you're going to be too lovey-dovey in the battlefield, you're not going to last too long. There's no punishment for this at all. That's the way the world was set up. That when there is a milchama, people are going to die. And he quotes the Gemara in Shavuos that says, "Machusa de kol lachai mishislam yonish." If you have a kingdom where one out of six of the able-bodied men end up dying over the course of the king's reign, because the king is waging wars, which he needs to do in order to maintain the security and well-being of his kingdom, he's not punished for that, because that is just a natural part of running a country, that there's going to be warfare and individuals are going to die. Even a Melchemes Rishus, even just to expand territory, is strictly speaking permitted, despite the fact that there will be many casualties. And if there are going to be casualties amongst your own people, and that's considered to be something which is justifiable, certainly if there are going to be civilian casualties on the other side. But what the Netziv doesn't say is that you have the right to specifically target members of the other side who you know to be innocent, who you know to be women and children, those who are really what we would call innocent bystander civilians. It's unfortunate if they have to be killed, but it doesn't say that you have the right to target them. And in fact, Roshamshon Rafael Hirsch says that really is, at the end of the day, why it is that Yaakov was upset at Shimon and Levi. He says explicitly, I don't have this in the materials, but it's Roshamshon Rafael Hirsch on the entire episode of Shechem, says, Asal Arog B'Kavonis Chafei HaPesha. You're not allowed to target those whom you know to be innocent civilians. And he says, Zeha yaha amun shalahem. This was the sin, this was the mistake, this was the transgression that was committed by Shimon and Levi. He says, to kill Shem, Shem and Chamor, 100% yashikoyach. That was perfectly fine. No problem about that. However, achem lo chasu al nashim chasrei magen, but they did not have mercy for those who were defenseless individuals recovering from the bris milah, who really did not need to be targeted. Lachen lo haisa kol hatzedakah, and therefore there was no justification for what they did. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh gives a possible svara as to how there could have been a justification in this particular context. And he says that this is the last source on page 8, we're skipping around a little bit. He says that Achen Hinei B'nei Yaakov lo haya b'daitzim l'arog ela b'al aveira. Really, they only wanted to go after the guilty parties. The problem, and they would have really been content going after Chamor and Shechem. What kind of, do you think that Shimon and Levi were just cruel-hearted, cold-blooded individuals who were knocking on the door and saying, ah, you're recovering from the bris milah, pow? Says Ella, Shekol b'nei Ya'ir, rasu l'amud b'peres k'negdom. You have a separate din, which is a din of Rodef. A din that hashkem, that somebody, haba lahargo, hashkem lahargecha, that somebody comes to kill you, so there's a din that you're supposed to kill them first. So he says that's what happened over here, that when Chamor and when Shimon and Levi targeted Chamor and Shechem, so you think about the current situation in Gaza. Sometimes you have innocent civilians, but sometimes you have individuals who want to be the human shields. They want to help out the terrorists. He said that's what was going on over here. They were standing in the way in order to prevent Shimon and Levi from killing their leader. And therefore, they had the halacha of Rodef if anybody falls into that particular category. So the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, under those circumstances, it really could be justified. The question is, how far can you possibly take the din of Rodef? If you're dealing with the din of Rodef, so then you have to be very, very careful, because the din of Rodef also requires, one second, that if you have the ability to stop somebody, you have the ability to disarm or disable somebody who is potentially going to be killing you, or to get in your way and to stop you and take and to stop you even by using lethal force, so that you only have the ability to disable them to the fullest degree necessary. If you can simply wound them without killing them, and then you kill them, so then you're actually guilty of shvichas damim. Then you're actually guilty of murder. So that's what the Sifsei Chachamim says at the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach. It says, Yaakov went out to battle against Esav. Vayirah Yaakov meod vayetzilo. He was scared and he was distraught. Was he both scared and distraught? So the Rashi says he was scared that he's going to get killed. Shema Yehoreg, he's distraught. Shema Yargus Acherim, maybe he's going to kill other people. So why be so upset you're going to kill other people? So Sifsei Chachamim brings an explanation that, of course, no reason to be upset if he's going to kill Esav, because if Esav was out, would try to kill him, and Yaakov would defend himself by eliminating Esav, so that's simply a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Rodef. No reason to be distraught about that per se. He says the reason he was distraught is because Esav didn't only come alone, he had his band of merry men, and he had all of these other individuals were with him, and they weren't necessarily out to get Yaakov per se. Maybe they would have gone after some of Yaakov's cohorts, but they weren't necessary. But because of the fact that this would only operate within the realm of a din of Rodef, so Yaakov was scared. Maybe he would have to stop those people to prevent them from killing other individuals. But maybe in the process he might kill them when he really could have just disabled them. And therefore, he was distraught. Oh, maybe there's a chance that I'm going to kill some of these people who really are not out necessarily to kill me, when I could really end up doing less. So with Rodef, it has to be with pinpoint precision, that you can't really go after anybody who does not absolutely 100% need to be killed. And therefore, Rabbi Bleich writes similarly, in all of these wars, if you're relying upon Rodef, that would not be a justification for taking out somebody who's really has no designs to kill you altogether, who would just be a civilian casualty. He says that if you need to, you want to save your own skin, and to save your own skin, you're going to kill another innocent individual. So then we would apply the principle of Maichos is the Dama Didach Sumach Tvei, who says your blood is redder than the individual, than the innocent person whom you're killing. So he says Rodef is not really the justification. Those who learn that we apply principles of Rodef, like the Sifsei Chachamim, to the altercation between Yaakov and Esav, would be saying that that wasn't really a war of one nation against another nation. Therefore, anybody who would be killed, it would be based on the laws of Rodef, when it applies and when it doesn't apply. It could be that the Or HaChaim HaKadosh is also understanding that this particular skirmish between Yaakov's family and the B'nai Shechem was also in that type of category, not really a war of one nation against another nation. But if I am really talking about a war of one nation against another nation, so then what we learn from the Maharal, what we learn from the Nitziv, and others talk about this as well, including Rav Zalman Saruskin and the Aznayim LaTorah, they all say that then this is simply an unfortunate consequence of war, that sometimes there will have to be civilian casualties. Now, how much of an obligation do you have to minimize those casualties? So it's a question. Let me take the question first.
Worried about people coming after you, can you just kill them all? And then after they killed them, I was going to ask about how you could, you know, just kill everyone else because you're worried they're all going to come at you and you're just going to kill them first.
Right, and you can't do that based on the principle of Rodef. They would have to actually be coming after you at the time, right? Well, Shechem is a different story, because Shechem was a direct enemy in the sense that they had taken their sister captive. They were holding their sister captive, and so that really was a situation where they needed to protect her. They needed to defend her. So and the people who had her captive weren't giving her up. So you got to do whatever is necessary. Now, as far as the steps that would need to be taken, go back to page 3. There's a very interesting source. It's quoted by Rav Asher Weiss. I believe the same source is quoted by, there was a posek in Eretz Yisrael who was the titular head of the Eretz Chemna Academy that we know puts out Sfarim Mareya Bazak of Shailos Tshuvos. His name was Roshal Yisraeli. It was a great posek in Eretz Yisrael. And he wrote a sefer called Amuda Yemini that deals with a lot of the modern day shilos that have to do with mechamos, of fighting wars in the state of Israel and things of that variety. And he has a very long shuva in Simon Tez Zion, in which he discusses the issue of civilian casualties and other things. And I believe he quotes this as well. And this is with respect to the War of Amalek. Before Shaul, when Shaul HaMelech was charged to destroy all of everybody in Amalek, we know he only did sort of half of the job. But one thing that Shaul did that we assume was proper before the beginning of the war, he knew there was an innocent population that lived amongst the Amalekim. They were a population that was actually friendly to Klal Yisrael. They were friendly. We know they were friendly. They were the Cainy population. They came from the same family as Yisrael. Yoel, Eishes, Chevro, Akeni. You know, they were good people. They helped us out. So Shaul said, listen, if I'm going to carpet bomb Amalek and kill everybody there, so the Amalekim all deserve to be killed, but not the people of Cainy. So he gave them the opportunity to get out. So he said, you should get out because I'm about to bomb the Amalekim, about to kill the Amalekim, and you are good people, so I want to spare you. And so this is brought as a raya, that when you do engage in war against an enemy, if there are innocent civilians, you give the innocent civilians an opportunity, first of all, to prove that they're innocent, an opportunity to get out. So this is really consistent with what the Israeli army has done in various battles of dropping leaflets and the like to all the people in the population saying, we're about to bomb the following areas tomorrow. So get out from those areas so that you won't be subject to the artillery. So this is 100% consistent. But at the same time, let's say that the Cainy would not have gotten out. So Shaul still had the obligation to go after Amalek. If they wouldn't listen, they would be prevented even from the Amalekim from getting out. So then, presumably, the Mechama would still need to be waged anyway. And a further indication of that is from the whole story in Divrei HaYomim, when David HaMelech explained to Shlomo, his son, why it is David wasn't allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash, right? So David says, you spilled so much blood in all of the wars that you waged, David HaMelech. David HaMelech spilled blood in wars justifiably. He was the king of Israel, and he had wars that he needed to fight against the Plishtim and so forth. But therefore, because of the fact that he did all of these, he shed so much blood, because of the fact you shed so much blood, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to David, you can't build the Beis HaMikdash. So the Radak says, what's going on? What blood is there that's being, he was just justified. He had enemies who were out to kill him. So that's not, why is that a bad thing? The Radak says, that's not a bad thing. But take a look, in the source of Zion on page 3, midway through, when you go to war, so there are going to be, there'll be collateral damage. There'll be those who are not from the enemies who are going to be killed, and so could be some of them were good men. Some of them may have been tzaddikim. Some of them may have been chassidim. There may have been some children. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu never said to David, I'm going to punish you. He didn't say, I'm punishing you as a result of this. He just said, I'm not going to let you build the Beis HaMikdash because it's a spiritual stain on your soul. David HaMelech's kavana was just to get rid of the Rishayim. So therefore, he's not held responsible based on the fact that there were some innocents who invariably got killed. Aval, get to the end of that line, but because of the fact that he did end up killing so many people that some of them may have been tzaddikim, so therefore he wasn't allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash, which stands for peace, l'chaparas avod, and for atonement of sin, l'ateres tefila, and for the crowning of of tefillah, a pure, unadulterated prayer. So these types of lodestars of the Beis HaMikdash really require somebody like a Shlomo HaMelech, who was just busy adjudicating disputes between, you know, women and whose child somebody, you know, belongs to, as opposed to somebody who fought wars and killed people. So therefore, it wasn't appropriate for him to build a Beis HaMikdash. So there are two different perspectives that are taken with respect to this comment of the Radak. One perspective is that what's clearly being said is lo nana shaleim, this is not something which is culpable. This is just a sad, inevitable byproduct of war, that there are going to be innocents who are killed. And that's the focus that Rav Asher Weiss and many others have with respect to this Radak. Others, like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, point out, yes, all of this is true, but at the same time, we see that it is a spiritual state on the soul. And that's why David HaMelech wasn't allowed to build a Beis HaMikdash. A similar medrash in the materials, I won't read it inside, that Avraham Avinu, after the war of against the four Mesopotamian kings who had conquered the five kings and had taken the Lot hostage, that after that war, so Avraham was kind of like a little bit worried, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to say, no, don't worry, Anochi Magen Lach Tzchacha HaBei Me'od, don't worry, I'm your shield, you're going to have a great reward. What was Avraham worried about? So according to one interpretation of the Medrash, what Avraham was worried about is, oh, maybe amongst all the people that I killed in war, maybe there was some innocence. And the Kodesh Baruch Hu reassures him. He says, no, don't worry. Nobody was innocent. You're going to get reward for every single person that you killed. Nobody, but he was nervous about it, because if somebody was innocent, so then he felt that it was something that would be a stain of sorts on his soul. But he didn't stop from going into war in the first place because of that reality. That's just part of war, but it's something to feel bad about. So if I don't let this thing points out, it's something to feel bad about. What's the nafka mina in terms of where you place the dogish, where you place the emphasis? So a question, Rabbi Robinson.
So the last point the Rav made, I think, is the key, is that feeling bad about, for sure. I wouldn't be comfortable saying this is a source, there's a spiritual stain in the soul. Because let's say, for example, I think it's more like a symbolic stira. Let's say, for example, a sword you can't use to make the Mizbeach, even if the sword was never used to kill anybody. Symbolically, a sword is something that's a stira to Mizbeach. So to say that, you know, if he made the right decision, I wouldn't want to say it is a stain on his soul, more that this person symbolically wouldn't be compatible with his bayah. We definitely come to the conclusion we'd rather not do it than to do it at all. I guess it's just the nuance of how it's being.
It's a fair comment, because that expression, spiritual state on the soul, doesn't appear in the sources. It's kind of like an extrapolation. And you know, maybe you could read it a little bit, you know, into what Avraham was saying as well, that he was, why was he mispache, why would this be a bad thing? So obviously it's not ideal. What ultimate effect it has is a different question, but obviously it's not ideal. Also runs to the question as well of, could a Kohen who killed in battle, would a Kohen be allowed to continue to Duchen afterwards, wherever Moshe Feinstein says, under those situations, the Kohen is a complete onus, then normally a Kohen who kills, even Bishogeg, would not be allowed to Duchen, but if it's in battle, so then he says, then he would be allowed to Duchen afterwards, but Rav Soloveitchik held differently. He held that it was an absolute prohibition, because something happens to an individual. Now, you could also say, no, it's an inconsistency. It's not necessarily a state, just an inconsistency in terms of what the Kohen, when he's dokening, what he stands for, similar to the story of David and the Beis HaMikdash. But clearly, it's something which is undesirable.
Yes.
It's undesirable.
He's talking,
right?
About Melchamas Mitzvah?
I'm sorry? Yes, even Melchamas Mitzvah. Even Melchamas Mitzvah. Even a Melchamas Mitzvah. Yes. Very, very fascinating.
Now,
even
a Melchamas Mitzvah. Recently, yeah. Yaakov Kamenetsky has a fairly well-known piece that each of the Avos were tested the opposite of their nature. So think of Avraham Avinu, his two big nisyonos were Girish Yishmael and the Akedah, which, you know, again, he didn't want to do it, but sometimes you're forced to have, so there's like, right. Sometimes in life you have to do what you don't want to do, but the Hashkafah definitely has to do with what the Rav is saying, is that we don't want to do these things.
Exactly, and then the Nafka Mina becomes, in terms of where you place the Dagesh, and here you do have a Machlokas Saposkin, but I would say it's a Machlokas not of like, 20 against 20, or 5 against 5, and we're like 50 against 1. But and this is with respect to what if you have the following question, which is that you know that the enemy is in a particular area. They're using innocent individuals or potentially, arguably, innocent individuals as human shields in the area. So if you would go door to door searching for terrorists in every single location, so you would be able to pinpoint with greater accuracy who's the terrorist and who's innocent, and minimize the number of civilian casualties. But on your side, you're going to end up having many more casualties this way. But if you bomb the area after giving whatever notice and warning that we see is appropriate to give ahead of time, but whoever is still there is still there, and you bomb the area, so your own troops are going to be much safer, but there probably will be more civilian casualties. So are you obligated to take the route in which you're going to put your own troops, even one soldier amongst your own troops, at greater risk in order to minimize the civilian casualties when you get to that point? Shaul, when he was giving sort of this opportunity to the Canaan to escape, he was not heightening the possibility or potential of greater casualties on his own side. He was giving them the opportunity to leave without necessarily heightening, that possibility. It's the same idea with respect to leaving open one side in battle, right? That we know that we learn, there's a Sifrei that learns from the whole story of the Melchama of Midian, where it says, "Vayitzpu'a Midian kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe," that Kadosh Baruch Hu gives the directive, you have to go against Midian because they caused Bnei Yisrael to sin and they caused a terrible magefa amongst the Jewish people. So because the Midian attacked you, so you're supposed to go against Midian. Kasher tziva Hashem. What's kasher tziva Hashem? The Sifrei says that in the manner in which you're going to leave open one of the directions of the city when you set siege around the city, it should only be mishalosh ruchoseh, from three sides. Enable the enemy to escape from the fourth side. And the Ramban codifies this as halacha. And the Ramban says, this is a Hasagas or Ramban on page 5, source Tezayin, that this applies to a mechemes harishus. This applies when it's not a mechemes mitzvah. As we said, you're defending yourself against an enemy that attacked you. That's a mechemes mitzvah. It wouldn't apply in this type of milchama. But from the lashon of the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim doesn't distinguish. He seems to indicate this would apply to any kind of milchama, even a mechemes mitzvah. The Minchas Chinuch makes that point. So Rabbi Gorin, who is the chief rabbi of Israel, wanted to argue that in every single milchama we have nowadays, we're defending ourselves against the enemy, we should allow for one side to be open so that the enemy would be able to escape. And Moshe Yisraeli said, "Are you kidding me? Loyal El Adas, you're going to allow the terrorists to escape?" When we talk about people escaping, like the Ramban is talking about Mechemes Harishus, where no, you don't really have a guilty party per se, so then you allow individuals to escape, but you don't allow terrorists to escape. Mm-hmm. And some explain, the Meshech Chochmah explains that the Rambam, who applies it to every war, what he really means is you want to weaken the morale of the enemy. If the enemy knows that they're completely besieged, then they're going to fight with much greater ferocity. If they know they have an escape hatch, so they're less likely to fight with the same ferocity, they'll just run away. But then it has to be that they're running away, not that they're running to some location where they're going to be able to build more tunnels and they're going to be able to reinforce their ammunition. That wouldn't be right. But what we do see from this entire halacha of leaving open aside is that if you have the ability for humanitarian pauses, so to speak, to leave open for those who are or could be identified to be, hopefully, the innocent civilians, then you do give them the opportunity to be able to get away and make sure that they're not getting away in order to harm you, that they really are, if to the extent that that really is plausible or possible, that you could have such individuals that would be able to get away. So you do all of those things. And those things, as long as they can be done without jeopardizing any of your troops, so that would be perfectly fine. But what if you would be jeopardizing your troops, like by going door to door, as opposed to bombing a particular area or a particular building? So most of the Meforshim say that we do not find anywhere in any halakhic literature that there would be an obligation to forfeit the life of a single Jewish soldier or a single Jewish individual in order to save the civilians from the other side, when that's going to be a consequence of this type of a pinpointed response, as opposed to doing a response that you do take whatever measures are certainly appropriate in order to get the civilians out of harm's way. But after you've done that, you're not really supposed to put your own soldiers, your own civilians, in jeopardy. And this is the conclusion that's drawn by Rav Yisraeli. It's the conclusion that's drawn by Rav Shlomo Duchovsky, who has a sefer, Lev Shomei LeShlomo, in which he talks about that these are yadim. It's the conclusion of my own Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schachter, that you don't put a single life in jeopardy. And it's the conclusion of Rav Avram Shapiro. Rav Avram Shapiro was asked this particular shaila, and he said very explicitly that this is something that the halacha absolutely does not require, that one of the most important principles of war, and this is a very important halacha, and that some of the authorities say this should be like, you know, war, milchama, Hilchos Milchama 101. What's Hilchos Milchama 101? Hilchos Milchama 101 is that you fight a war to win. You fight a war to win. We saw in the story in Gittin, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai saw at the end of the second Beis HaMikdash period, there were Jewish rebels, the Bir Yonim, and they were fighting a war that they couldn't win, and just everybody would end up being massacred by the other side. He said, you can't fight a war like that. You only fight a war ad ridita. You fight a war for purpose of winning the war. One of the things that you need to win the war is to strengthen the morale of your own soldiers. Your own soldiers feel you're going to put their lives in jeopardy in order to save people on the other side. That's not going to be very good towards winning the war. To have that type of a morale, to have that type of an attitude. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is sort of the one dissenting view. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, as Zatzal did say, that he felt that because of the fact that we see that there is this wealth of literature, whether from the story of Shechem, whether from the story of Shaul and the Cainy, we see that there is this literature that we're supposed to, or leaving open one side of the battlefield, if you understand it like the Ramban, as a matter of compassion, that we do try to do what we can in order to minimize civilian casualties. So this is something that should be taken into the cheshbon when you're planning out military strategy, even though it might potentially cause additional deaths. But I have to tell you that even those who might, you know, agree with the general sentiment that we consider it to be a sad and a tragic thing when civilian casualties happen, pretty much everybody disagrees with him on this particular point. But it's worthy of mention. There is somebody who wrote an article in the Tchumen Journal, Rabbi or Dr. Nuria Gutel, who seems to side with that particular position. But again, he wasn't, you know, presenting it as a posek per se. He was just giving, you know, the general literature. The other side of the coin, which is very important, and you may have heard it, but it's important to know what the source is the Medrash Rabbah on Koheles, what you have on page 4, which is that one person who made the mistake of being too compassionate was Shaul HaMelech. We know when he waged the war of Amalek, that happened to be a unique war where Kadosh Baruch Hu says you have to wipe out all the men, women, and children, even though it seems like it is perhaps a very harsh type of an approach, but nonetheless, that's a din of Amalek. We don't have Amalek nowadays. There might be a metaphysical type of Amalek, any nation that's bent on destroying the entire Jewish people, but in terms of genealogical Amalek, it doesn't exist. So our wars, notwithstanding any kind of homiletic sermons on the topic by Rav Soloveitchik in the name of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, those are all purely homiletic. In terms of the pure halacha, we don't have Amalek nowadays. So we don't target men, women, and children. But Shaul HaMelech had mercy. He said, "Anashim chatu, anashim machatu." The men sinned, so what did the women do? Hatap machatu. How did the children sin? Why should I kill the animals? How did they sin? So he spared them. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Yotzes bas kol, a voice went out from heaven and said, "Al tit tzadik habe." Don't be too much of a tzadik. Sometimes when you're too much of a tzadik, you end up going in exactly the opposite direction when it contravenes the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the wisdom of the Torah. Rabbi Shimon Lakish Omer, Kol mi shenase rachamon memochem achazari. This is about 4 lines before the end of that source, Yud Aleph on page 4. Anybody who is overly merciful when they are supposed to be harsh, sof shenase achazari memochem rachamon, then they end up being cruel when they're supposed to be merciful. And we see that happen with Shaul HaMelech. He ended up killing an entire city of Kohanim that provided refuge for David HaMelech. He ended up being cruel himself because of the fact that he thought he's being merciful. But by being merciful, by sparing the enemy when you're not supposed to, so that ends up being cruel towards your own people. And that's what we end up having in these situations. Yes, of course, we do our utmost in order to minimize the civilian casualties, but if you go overboard and you're going to put your own people at risk as a result, causing deaths on your own side, weakening the morale of your soldiers on your own side, lessening, diminishing your ability to win the war, in which case you're subjecting yourself to possible and probable more terror in the future, that ends up being not an act of mercy, that ends up being an act of cruelty. And that's a very important consideration. The last consideration that I will mention is that we do have these Hague Convention rules. Why are the Hague Convention rules relevant at all? They're relevant to some degree because to whatever extent we enter into some type of an international treaty, and this is something that Rav Shaul Yisraeli dwells upon, he says rules of war to some degree are governed by Dina de Malchusa Dina. Dina de Malchusa Dina means that every government has the right to promulgate laws of its own land when it comes to like taxation, sweeping economic rules of regulation for the betterment of society. But it also includes rules of war. The fact that warfare is engaged in altogether by the nations of the world, kikach nosa olam, part of Dina de Malchusa Dina, this would be Dina de Malchusos Dina. It's a Dina of all of the Malchusos. Especially if you enter into a treaty. So the Rambam, you look in page 6, source Chafalav, he talks about how we had to give special treatment to the Givonim. We had to give special treatment to the Givonim, even though they were one of the seven nations, because Bnei Shekarsu Lemberis, because we entered into a treaty, whether that was a treaty that was a good treaty, a bad treaty, we were fooled into the treaty, but you enter into a treaty, so that's something which you're supposed to honor. I'll say, by the way, that the Rambam and the Ramban, both are of the opinion against Rashi, that even when you wage war against the seven nations whom you are instructed to wipe out entirely, you first give them the opportunity for shalom. You always give an opportunity for peace. Say, ceasefire? Oh, wonderful ceasefire. But you know what a ceasefire requires? A ceasefire requires that the other nation make itself completely subordinate and submissive to the Jewish people. That's the idea of reaching out for peace, is that there has to be that type of an understanding that you're not going to wage war anymore. If you're going to do that, that's not considered to be peace. So this is also...
Fair to assume that UN resolutions have no value?
I'm sorry?
UN resolutions have any impact?
No, the U.S. resolutions are not treaties. The UN. Yeah, yeah. The UN resolutions are not treaties. So therefore, that doesn't have any bearing whatsoever. Of course not. But this is, I believe, a very important principle with respect to what it means. If you take a look at the Rambam in source Chav Zion on page 7. As he says that Enosin Mechama Adam Olam Shikorim Lo Shalom Echa Echa Mechemes Veshus Echa Mechemes Mitzvah. He holds even Mechemes Mitzvah. You reach out and you give them the opportunity for peace. But what does peace mean? It means Yulacha Lamas Vaducha. Third line, that they're going to be subject to your jurisdiction and to your sovereignty, and they're going to be subordinate to you. And they're going to also accept Abdus, meaning that they are subject to your instruction, to your army, and to your rules. Ve'abdus, this is the end of the third to last line, the first paragraph. Ve'abdus, she'kablu, she'yu nivzim u'shfeilim lamata, that they're going to be subordinate to you, below yarima rosh b'Yisrael, and they're not going to say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Ela yu kivushim tachas yodam, but rather they're going to be subordinated under you, and not that, a ceasefire, so that they can build up their terrorist operations, so that they can keep our hostages. What kind of a mas and abdus is it if they're still holding up hostages? Makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But getting back to the international convention, so then there is this notion that it is something to be respected, but what is one of the fundamental hallmarks of Dina de Malchusa Dina? That is, the law of the land means the way people follow the law of the land. We're not obligated to follow the law of the land more than anybody else follows it.
If I would cross a street and there's a law against jaywalking and there's a policeman standing on the other corner and I walk across the street while there's a red light and the policeman says, hi, good morning, have a nice day, because nobody could care less about this particular law, that's not a din de malchus adina. Okay, so just take that to the nth degree. You have wars. What do other countries do when they wage war? It's not exactly reasonable to say that if they are taking certain measures to protect themselves and are not being more scrupulous with respect to civilian casualties, that they're going to hold Israel to a higher standard. But despite all of that, I believe if you look at what the army of Israel did, and that's why I started out, and I'll finish with it, by saying that it's the most moral army in the world, they actually do pay attention. All those people who are screaming and yelling, war crimes, violation of international, did any of them even know what the Geneva Convention, do they really think the Geneva Convention say, oh, if you're attacked by terrorists and they use human shields, so then you're obligated to lay down and die and give up your country and have all of your people murdered. They really think that's what it says? Maybe they can point, like, you know, to the chapter and verse. If that's what it says, the whole world be in a lot of trouble if that's what the Geneva Convention say. What it says is you can't engage in indiscriminate attacks on civilian populations. Not indiscriminate attacks when you're dropping leaflets and warning people ahead of time and being very, very careful about the different targets that are being chosen for the attacks. You have to look at what the provisions actually say. It says that you are not supposed to attack with biological weapons, with nuclear weapons, with landmines that are with the scope of destruction cannot be limited. I believe all of these rules are sensible rules, but they have to be followed by the rest of the world as well. It would kind of be nice if the other side followed these rules and it didn't actually target innocent civilians, and somebody would say, oh, you know, they're not really following the rules. But to the degree in which there are rules, so it is something that we take seriously, but I think that's something where we can really have a tremendous amount of pride in how the Israeli army is acting in a fashion of Or La'amim, as a light unto nations, whether the nations want to allow the light to go in or not, in terms of how these matters are conducted. And we pray that in this month, only a couple of weeks away from the celebrating Hanukkah, which is all about having the Or extinguish the Choshech of Yavon and the evil of the world, that the light of the above. Above board conduct and the exemplary conduct of the Israeli army and the Jewish people will be a light that will become brighter for all those in the world, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should certainly respond to that light with the illumination from above, that all of those who are in captivity shall be freed and brought home safely, and that we should emerge victorious in the war, and that we should all take a lesson from everything that's happened to increase in our own Achdus and Avodas Hashem.
I don't know why.